Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to your Help for HD News channel update. This is Melissa Biliardi, and I'm your host tonight. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio. Click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 86,000 listeners, for your support and interest in Help for HD programming. Tonight, we have a whole panel here. It's going to be a quick show, but we have lots of information to cover. And we're going to be giving you an update on the HSG clinical trial for Huntington's disease called FIRST HD and ARC HD. Our incredible special guests are Sam Frank. He's an MD, and he's also the PI for FIRST and ARC HD. Then we have Claudia Testa. She's MD and PhD, FIRST HD and ARC HD. She's the co-PI, and that stands for Principal Investigator. Then we have David Stamler. He is an MD, and he's also CMO, which is the Chief Medical Officer at Auspex Pharmaceuticals. We have Dr. Sarah Janicki. She is also a site investigator at Columbia for FIRST HD. And tonight we'll be discussing the changes to the FIRST HD protocol with more sites for added convenience for everyone. We'll also be talking with site investigator, also a caregiver is here with us tonight. We're going to get her perspective on how to make clinical trials more positive experience for our HD individuals and caregivers. And so tonight, let's welcome Dr. David Stamler. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, Melissa. It's nice to be back on the show. And
it's great to have you back.
Say hello to all the listeners online. Yeah.
We've got a whole crew in the chat room, too, so thank you, everyone, for calling in, tuning in. So let's talk about FIRST HD. What are the changes to the FIRST HD protocol?
Right. So before I start, I just wanted to say thanks to everyone in the HD community who's listening and who's been giving to the FIRST and the ARC HD trials. And just to let you know, we're trying to give as much back to you as we can along the way. So to remind you, FIRST HD is a clinical trial that is investigating a new agent that we call ST-809, and that's for the treatment of chorea associated with HD. And ARC HD is a trial for subjects on tetrabenazine who would switch to ST-809 overnight. And subjects who participate in both of these trials would be eligible for a long-term treatment study at the end of their participation in the initial trials. The one thing I wanted to mention before talking about the minor changes to the protocol is that we think that the drug really has the potential to offer an improved tolerability or improved chorea control compared to tetrabenazine, which is why we're so eager to test it in the clinical trial. And I think you'll hear a lot from Sam and Claudia and the caregiver that we have online how we go about testing a drug to try and figure something like that out. Now, as often happens with clinical trials, that during conduct, we learn more about the trial and how to run it and how to perhaps adjust it so it works better for the patients and for the doctors conducting the trials. And we have made some minor adjustments to the study to make it easier for study subjects to participate. And some of those changes include broadening the use of some medications that are allowed, such as antidepressants. You'll hear a little bit more about the clinical sites, but the sites that are participating are aware of these changes that we're putting into the protocol. And so they will know whether or not you can participate in the trials. And if anyone is interested in getting more details about the trials and the specifics, you could get that information in a variety of ways. You can go to clinicaltrials.gov. If you wanted more specific information. And you could also go to the HSG website, which is Huntington-Study-Group.org.
Yeah, or HSGLimited.org.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
Okay, so there you go.
Very, very well said, Dave. Now, did you add more sites? Did I hear that we added more sites?
We did. We, you know, we've, in the last, I'd say, month to 6 weeks, several news sites have been coming online or already online. And some of those news sites are in Ohio, in Tennessee, in Kentucky, Indiana, and Vermont. So if you are in one of those states and are interested in participating, you can call the Huntington Study Group number to find out the specific location of the center. And that number is 800-487-7671, or you can go to the website that that we mentioned a little while ago, and you can get more details about the trial as well right when you get to their website.
Sounds like we have a little bit of background noise there. I don't know what that is.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Now, there's also a travel allowance, and that's working out really well.
Yeah, the travel, and I know when Dr. Janicki talks about their experience, we thought it would be really important to not only cover the costs of the travel and lodging if necessary, but that we're really trying to make it as easy for a study participant as possible. So when at all possible, we try and pay those costs directly so that participants don't have any out-of-pocket costs.
Fantastic. And for a complete list of the states that the study is available, or the trial, FIRST-HD and ARC-HD is actually on both clinicaltrials.gov and also the hsglimited.org site. It's, I believe, in with the brochure information. If you click on the sites, it'll give you a complete list of all of the sites that are doing the studies, which is incredible. It has the phone number, the web link. It has the contact. It has their email address and everything. And, of course, you'll probably want to call HSG first thing, too, to find out if the study is in your local area. And if not, there is a potential for travel allowance and housing allowance. So that's a really good thing that we should point out to everyone. If you're
Melissa?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I thought you were finished sentence, Claudia.
I just wanted to
point out that the travel, covering travel and direct covering of travel is something that got put together by HSG and Auspex and the study team based on feedback from the patients and families who were trying to enroll in the study when we first started, and said that that was something that would make it a lot more feasible and a lot more doable for both the patients and the sites. So that's one of the adjustments that got made as we went based on that community feedback.
Fantastic. Okay, so then back to David, Dr. Samler, when are you planning on wrapping up the enrollment?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Yeah, we're really hitting our stride, and I'd say we're kind of in the home stretch of enrollment. So we think we're going to close enrollment in the very near future. That's always a tricky thing to be, to know precisely when it's going to end. But what we really want people to know is if they're interested in participating, they should really call soon. And, we anticipate the enrollment will close very soon, that we're going to have our results by the end of this year.
Fantastic. Okay, Dr. Sam Frank is up next. He's the PI, the principal investigator. And he's going to tell us a little bit about how a clinical trial works. Hi, Dr. Frank. How are you? Welcome back.
Hi, Melissa. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me back. Thank you for having all of us back.
You're welcome.
So just in terms of a clinical trial, talking in broad brush strokes, so to speak, it's a remarkably complex process, even for studying something simple. And, of course, it starts with an idea, and somebody has to think about an intervention in some way and then go on to develop a process of how to study that intervention or idea. And this is where we get into developing criteria for who would best fit and what we want to exclude. So if we're going to test something that has to do with surgery, for example, we don't want people on blood thinners. So it's really for safety, and safety is the primary concern for just about every clinical trial and is built into the protocol or the process of studying that intervention. And then we have to pick the best way to look at change. So for first HD, for example, it's chorea. So what is the best way to measure chorea, because that's what we anticipate that SD809 will treat best. Then it's the most important part. Once we have all that in place, we have volunteers. And that's where we need the community to come out and volunteer. And it's one of the parts of clinical trials that takes the longest, is to get people to volunteer. And that's every clinical trial. That's not specific for anyone. And that's why especially we need people in the Huntington's disease community to come out and volunteer for this. And then we get the word out there, advertising through clinics, networks, meeting support groups, online, blog talk, radio, whatever it may be. And so that's basically kind of the big picture of the development of a clinical trial. And then keeping people in the trial or retaining people, that's really, I think, one of the strong points of going to a site that you're familiar with, and for people that are familiar with Huntington's disease, for example, because we really develop and maintain relationships with our study participants and the study partners. It's really important for people to finish out their volunteer commitment to study, so that we can fully understand the impact of whatever is we're studying on both how it works and the safety. Then, of course, we have to analyze everything and get it published and out there and submit it to the FDA or whatever else is going to happen with that information. So that's just kind of, in a big picture, how a clinical trial.
A lot of coordination, a lot of organization, and you had a question here, and I think I know the reason why, academic network, but can you address that?
Why an academic network?
Yes.
I would say for a lot of diseases it may not be necessary. So, you know, if we're studying high blood pressure, that's a problem that's easy to measure. It's widely seen in doctors' offices across the world, and the stakes are relatively low since there are lots of options. So we may just be looking for a better treatment. And I think that that's not true for Huntington's disease and other rare diseases. And so academic networks tend to work better for clinical care and clinical research for rare diseases like Huntington's disease, where we can pool resources, where people in terms of providers are familiar with patients with that disease process and can be better at measuring what it is that we want to measure, whether it's how well something works or the safety. So if you take a look at a general neurologist, they actually see very few cases of Huntington's disease over the course of a career where an academic center can follow 100, 200 people. And so you put those number of people together in an academic network, and we can really pool our resources to move forward with clinical care and research. So I think that's the other reason, is that we can put our heads together, and there's a lot of communication if there are academic networks. There's the Huntington Study Group meeting, for example. There's a lot of communication and talk at that meeting, and a lot of ideas that get vetted and put out there and started. And it's academic networks like that we can move forward and get the word out about what we're doing in terms of research and clinical care.
That's a huge benefit, because most people in a normal situation, for example, myself with my son, we don't have access to that. We have to travel hundreds and hundreds of miles to get to expert care. So having that offered in a clinical trial setting as well is really a big, big, big benefit. And I don't think we should forget to mention that being seen by experts is really important and critical to good care.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Now, Dr. Frank, can you tell me what the main difference between now with the new protocol and before? Because, you know, we put out a lot of information in the beginning, and now there's a different protocol for first HD. Can we just kind of put it in a nutshell for everyone?
Sure. Well, it's not a different protocol. I would call it an updated protocol, and the changes are relatively minor. in terms of what we're studying, how long, visits, all the safety measures, none of that is different. So we're really studying the same thing and in the same way. What is slightly different are looking at medications that people either are taking or have taken in the past.
Okay.
But in terms of the protocol itself, that really does not change.
Okay, so the difference from before to now, exactly.
So, I mean, again, these are, in terms of the protocol itself and what we're doing, there's really no significant difference. But the minor changes that we've updated in terms of people that are taking now, we're always taking a look at antidepressants since they're commonly used in Huntington's disease for multiple reasons, since mood and anxiety disorders are common in Huntington's disease. And so we are taking a look at which antidepressants are used and in which doses, and so there were some minor adjustments related to that. And in addition, as is posted on clinicaltrials.gov, at first people could not have been exposed to tetrabenazine, but it is possible that if they're not currently on tetrabenazine, but they were in the remote past, that they could potentially be a candidate to volunteer for first HD.
Okay. And, of course, each case is probably slightly different, but that's the main difference, so that's good to know.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I'm going to hit the sites again because it looks like we had 31 before, 2 in Canada, 29 in the U.S. sites, and it looks like we have 29 plus maybe 2 more or 3 more maybe. So that's a good thing.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. The list of sites is listed on the Huntington Study Group site. That's probably the best place and most up to date.
Yes,
to take a look.
I did notice that on the clinicaltrials.gov site, they do not have the contact information. The list, which is in a table format on the Huntington or the HSGLimited.org site, is very detailed, and you can actually contact them directly if you wish. It's probably a good idea to both contact them and also contact HSG, I would imagine. Okay, next we have Dr.
And that list will keep getting updated.
Yeah.
So while we have sites that are fully active and definitely on that list, we have sites even this week that are getting green-lighted that'll appear.
Right.
On the list, and if you call the number, maybe already in process.
Yep.
So
try to make things more convenient for people.
There are more sites that are getting up and running, and as they get up and running and available, they'll be posted on the Huntington Study Group website.
Okay. And that was Dr. Testa, right, talking?
Yes.
Okay. You're up, girl. Now, let's talk about the participation in research. Why participate in research? Why is it so important? And if you could
really
talk about the phases of research.
And the phases of research, great. So, I mean, the bottom line is that it really can't be done without the HD community. It doesn't really matter what a great scientific theory we have or how lovely the mice look or how well the transgenic sheep behave. You know, if it doesn't work in real life for real people, then it's not what we're looking for the long run. The only way to find out if something is really going to be useful, great for HD patients and families, to prove whether that's true or whether it's not true and we need to move on, is with those critical volunteers. So that's the main reason why. It's really the only way to get the information that the community needs to know how to carry things forward, to develop new treatments, whether it's symptomatic treatments like we're discussing with these particular trials, or neuroprotective treatments, or disease-modifying, or an ultimate cure. It doesn't matter what level we're talking about. It's all reliant on those volunteers. So phases of research, We talk about starting where USPIC started with testing a new compound in healthy volunteers, people who don't have Huntington's disease, making sure it doesn't have any immediate bad reactions, that she gets absorbed and goes to where we think it's going, and then testing it a little bit in people with Huntington's disease for safety, again, to make sure that the downsides don't outweigh the potential benefits, because if something, if the cure is worse than the problem, then you don't want to carry that forward. And then finally, you want to get enough information so that you feel really convinced that the new treatment is effective and safe for people with Huntington's disease, that treats the symptom you're looking for, it has the impact or effect you're looking for, and has good safety. So the so the current trials, for example, for SD809, are the ones that are really going to nail that information down for both benefit, does it really help chorea and Huntington's disease, and for safety, to know that USPIC will be able to carry the drug forward and get it approved to the market. So when you're looking at an earlier phase of research, just to explore, see if the compound is safe, try to figure out if it's really working, but not necessarily get enough information to prove that it's working, those earlier exploratory phases are really important to choose the right things to go forward, but it might take a long time between that study and ultimately something coming to market. These trials are much closer. They're the end phases, so we would expect this answer to turn around relatively quickly. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That distinction?
And I have to say, one thing that I heard you state, and it warmed my heart and made me very happy, and that is the fact that you listened to the community when we said we need help in reimbursement or an allowance or whatever. And to me, you get 5 stars for that, because if we don't listen to the community, we won't really know what it is that they need. So I think that is fantastic, and I love to hear that, and I applaud you for that. Thank you so much. And then, again, we want to remind people that not only will you be participating in a clinical trial, you will be sacrificing, you know, for science, for future generations, but you will also have access to expert care, which is a very, very good byproduct of your endeavor. So thank you, Dr. Testa. We have Dr. Sarah Janicki up next. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
Thanks. Really glad to be back. Thanks so much for including me in this discussion.
Oh, yes. And now we're going to be talking with Dr. Janicki about being a site investigator and also site coordinator and what that means. Can you kind of go over that for us?
Yeah, of course. I'm going to be speaking today on behalf of both myself and our wonderful site coordinator, Rhonda Klaus, so I'll do the best that I can here. What I would say is that, overall, we've really had an excellent experience with this trial so far. As a site investigator, I've been impressed with the level of safety and oversight in this study. So, potential participants who are interested, the best way to sort of find out more information about the study is to contact through the HSG website or the different mechanisms that all the other doctors have mentioned. But as part of the study protocol, there's very close contact between investigators and coordinators and participants in this study. Along the lines of sort of every week, we're in some form of contact with our participants, either by telephone call or in-person visit. So what that means is, every participant really has close hands-on attention over the course of this study. As an investigator, that makes me feel like I'm able to provide a high level of care and ensure participant safety, which is my first priority. I think that our participants so far have really enjoyed that close contact. Even if they're not happy to see me, they're always happy to see Rhonda. And in some cases, actually, it's improved overall health care, I think, for some of our participants. We've sort of we've been in contact with their other health care providers, and in some cases have sort of tuned up some other medications that they might have been on for other conditions and helped their health. So I think that's sort of an indirect but important benefit. And you know, circling back to what Dr. Stamler and Dr. Testa were talking about before in terms of the transportation factor, it's really been seamless for us. I give Auspex tremendous kudos because, to the point where one of our participants, they've provided transportation pickup from their home to our medical center, and it's pretty much door-to-door, and they never see, the participant never sees an invoice for any of that. I mean, it's just they're sort of picked up and dropped off, and that's it. So it's really been completely seamless. so that's been fantastic. There's been, I think, some flexibility within the study. So whereas, you know, before I highlighted the safety mechanisms that are in place within that, there is flexibility. So some of our participants like to travel, right? So we encourage that. So within the study, sometimes study drug has to be shipped to participants. We've had a good experience with that, utilizing FedEx and FedEx centers. So if the person's within the 50 states, we can reach them with study drug adjustments. So that's allowed them, different people, the flexibility to travel. So in terms of, I would say the nuts and bolts of the study, it's really been a very good experience, I think, for us and hopefully for our participants as well.
Very, very good. And unfortunately, Rhonda couldn't be with us tonight to talk about the site coordination part of it, but I think you've really highlighted the good points there. I can't stress enough how important it is that you're working with the primary care doctors or other doctors that the patients are seeing. That's incredible. We all need teams of doctors helping us. It seems the Huntington's situation is very complicated.
Right. And I don't want to speak for everyone, but I know investigators as a whole really want to make sure that a patient's entire treatment team is on board. And we've really had an excellent experience in reaching out to general practitioners, cardiologists, what have you, in that they want to facilitate participation in the study as much as possible within the safety guidelines that are in place.
Can I ask you a quick question? How important is the role of the caregiver in all of this?
Right, so that's a great question. Absolutely crucial, of course, as in I think all areas of HD. Sort of from a strict guidelines point of view, and I'll let Drs. Frank and Testa speak to this. We really do want close caregiver participation in this study because we need pretty close feedback both from participants and from their caregivers who see them very frequently because we're looking in the decisions that we have to make in this study, we need a lot of feedback. So that's sort of from a guidelines point of view. But, more than that, I would say even more importantly, it's a group decision to participate in these types of studies. It's not just the participant. It's a lot of times a family discussion. And in a lot of cases, our participants have come to us. They're interested in and of themselves, but, their family members are very interested in trying to improve knowledge about Huntington's disease and improve treatment both for their loved ones and for other people with HD. And so they are equal partners in this. Caregivers are equal partners in this study. They're not the study participants, but they are that. They're playing that crucial supporting role.
And are you finding that there are more than one, maybe, subject and within a family that can participate?
You know, we haven't had that experience at our site, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case.
Interesting. Well, and we happen to have a caregiver with us tonight, and her name is Rossi Fisher. Hi, Rossi. How are you?
Hello, Melissa. Thank you for putting this all together. Happy to be here.
You are so welcome. My job is very fun. Tell us your experience interacting with the study site.
Well, first, I think both my husband and I feel very motivated to participate in any study that we feel qualified to participate in, because we do happen to live near places that provide care for my husband with Huntington's, and we can get there fairly easily. We live in Richmond, but we can go. There's a center here. There's also a center in Charlottesville, and we've also been to this, to Johns Hopkins. So we've been participating in studies for over 15 years, and it of course, someone said, how vital is the, how important is a caregiver? Good heavens. Vital.
Good
heavens. Well, I know you're just asking for everyone's information, but it certainly, as the patient becomes less able to act in his own best interest, it becomes even more and more important. My husband has been interested in doing these studies, so that's been good. But I just think we are lucky in that we live near these different places of excellence and that study Huntington's. We've had good care, I think a main thing is that you have, after you've been seen for a while, you certainly have trust in the people who are treating the patient. You develop a relationship with them. You develop a trust in them. And excuse my grandfather clock.
That's okay.
And it's just we are also we are very fortunate in that my husband, as I said, does want to do this, and I do too. We're totally motivated to do whatever we can to make your work easier.
Well, we want to thank you for your participation, for your sacrifice, and your willingness to get on the radio here and tell everyone about your motivation, your experiences. Now, have you had any barriers or obstacles that you've overcome with going through the study visit?
Not so much, no. We didn't mind going to Hopkins, as I said. We didn't mind going. We don't mind going to Virginia, and we have just generally, we really, really are anxious to participate in any study that we can, that we're qualified for.
Fantastic. And then your experience with travel, have you traveled much with this?
Only to those places, and it's fairly, my husband's from Baltimore, so we would kind of combine it with a family visit up there to Hopkins from Richmond, and it did get so that was kind of hard. We are lucky in that we financially have the means to do this, to do the travel, and that's a huge, huge, huge plus that we are able to afford it, and just to try to get him the best care possible. We're lucky in that sense. We're blessed in that sense.
Very good. Do we have any other topics that we wanted to really touch on real quick before we close the show?
So
this is Claudia. I just wanted to thank
Rossi
not only for their 15 years as a couple of participation, but she herself has been a research subject in cohort and now in Enroll HD.
Very good.
So, Melissa, I had a question for Rossi, which is, what advice might she give to a a patient or a caregiver if they're thinking about research, but they're reluctant to go ahead with that?
I would say, what in the world could you possibly say that would be against joining this study? You certainly care about your own patient's health, and you care about your children's or other people who may have this gene. And there's research, as I understand it, going on all over the world. So can you do your part? I mean, we already do a lot, but we can do more in terms of participating in trials. I would just say, can you do just a little bit more? And that you do get better care. I mean, you do get good care when you participate in a trial, and it's often happens that you get even more help because of just one visit you can get. We certainly experienced that here at the center in Richmond where Dr. Tester is. And so it can, and I think the more eyes that are looking at the patient, the better off he is, and you are. We're all in this together. This affects all of us. We're all in this together.
Good, very good.
Thank you,
everyone. That was Dr. Stamler. Dr. Frank, thank you so much. As a PI, you're doing a fantastic job. And Dr. Tessa,
thank you for having us on again.
And Dr. Janicki, thank you so much. Rossi, you're a sweetheart, and I hope to meet you someday.
That would be nice. Thank you so much. I look forward to that. Thank you.
And I would also love to interview you on the show someday, too, if you're open to it. Just to get
I'm open to any time spreading any word about Huntington's. I'm open
to
that.
Wonderful.
Yes, very, very. All right. Well, thank you so much, Melissa.
Aww.
Thank you to everyone.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and close the show tonight. We actually just want to make a quick announcement. Health for HD International is putting on a symposium this year in July 18 and 19. If you're interested in coming to listen to, we have 12 very high-profile keynote speakers now. Go to our website, helpforhd.org. Click on the events tab and look and see what we're doing. It's going to be an amazing symposium, our first this year. So this concludes our show tonight. I just want to thank, again, Dr. Sam Frank, Dr. Claudia Testa, Dr. David Stamler, Dr. Sarah Janicki, Mrs. Rossi Fisher. Thank you so much, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Come back and listen to the on-demand episodes. We have 178 episodes for you to look at and listen to. Don't forget about the free app, Help for HD, the original mobile connection to education resources and information about JHD and HD. Also find us on Facebook, Help for HD. And everyone have a great night.
Good night.